ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello there, Selena Greenback for the first Country Hour of 2026, and hope you had a good new year. Here was me thinking January 1 would be a pretty quiet day. We had two big announcements. The big talking point is these tariffs that China's slapped on Australian beef. Well, beef we send there over a certain annual quota. That's something we'll unpack a little bit more in just a moment. And a very welcome announcement for oyster growers in Stansbury to open back up for business, and a plea now to ensure quality testing for our seafood is fully funded into the future.
Definitely a sense of relief. It's also a reminder of why our South Australian Shellfish Quality Assurance Program is so important, because the oysters picking up on everything that the ocean has, and our monitoring program picks up on all of that.
If you'd like to share your thoughts on anything I cover today, those stories and more, let me know on my talkback number. It's 1300 160 222, or the text line is 0467 922 783. And given now we've officially waved 2025 goodbye, if you had any yearly rainfall totals that you'd like to share, you can send them through. Also, please, again on those numbers, 1300 160 222, or the text line 0467 922 783. But let's get into it, because, yeah, New Year's Day brought the news that China's Ministry of Commerce had slapped a 55% tariff on any Australian beef over and above an existing quota of 200,000 tonnes per year. As Elsie Adamo reports, it's a move that's been met with disappointment and dismay by the wider Australian industry.
Among the first group to voice their concerns was the Australian Meat Industry Council, AMIC, which described the new tariffs as not fair or appropriate, flying in the face of the long-standing, mutually beneficial trade relationship Australia has with China. AMIC CEO Tim Ryan claims the tariffs have the potential to reduce Australian beef exports to China by about one-third compared to the last 12 months, reducing export income by more than $1 billion.
So Australia has been allocated about 200,000 tonnes of access into the market. That will be tariff-free, but once we trigger that volume, we'll have to pay a 55% tariff, which will be prohibitive going forward. So effectively, it means a 200,000-tonne cap on what we can trade. If you compare that to recent trade performance over the last 12 months, we've shipped over a little bit over 300,000 tonnes. So we're kind of going or losing about a third of our current trade into China.
And is there any way of getting around this, or might they change their mind? Because, I mean, I understand Australian beef is very popular in China.
Yeah, and that's the case we've been making throughout this year-long investigation China's been through. The decision they've taken is in response to the domestic industry lobbying that they've been affected by imports. We've pushed strongly that Australia hasn't necessarily been the cause of any damage to their domestic industry. And as you say, our beef is extremely popular. Chinese consumers have developed a long preference for Australian beef. We've been in the market for a very long time and would like to continue to do so. Ultimately, once we hit our quota allocation for the year, we'll have to redivert that trade elsewhere.
Australian Meat Industry Council Chief Executive Officer Tim Ryan speaking to Michael Condon. He says the meat industry and trade officials will continue to negotiate and try to gain an exemption. Australian beef accounted for just 8% of China's overall beef imports in 2024, compared with nearly 80% coming from South America. Cattle Australia Chair Gary Edwards believes once Australia hits its quota, other markets will take the product.
It's something that we've discussed with our contemporary red meat industry bodies, that we do expect, and we reasonably expect it to be treated differently to this, because the massive increase of beef imports that have gone into China over the last couple of years has really come from South America, and it's disappointing to see that Australia has been treated the same as those countries.
You would have been fine with South America getting a quota put on it, basically, but not Australia.
Well, this is really around what's the source and what's the problem here that's causing this issue for Chinese beef producers. And the issue is the massive amount of beef that's been redirected from South America that was traditionally going into the United States market, that as tariffs have been imposed on those countries and they've had reduced access, they've rediverted massive volumes of beef and put it into China at very moderate pricing, which has obviously had an impact on that market. That's certainly not what Australia's done. Australia has continued to supply high-quality Australian beef at pricing that's consistent with the rest of our global contemporaries and is really sought to continue to meet the demand of Chinese consumers for our very high-quality product.
What impact do you think this will have on Australia's red meat industry?
Well, fortunately, it's unlikely to have an impact for several months. The earliest potential impact may be around May, June, based off current volumes, but we'll wait and see. Hopefully, that gives us time to engage in further discussions with our Chinese contemporaries and to hopefully moderate this position that we've seen imposed, because a 50% tariff imposition is a very blunt instrument, and that will very significantly disrupt trade if that is how it continues to roll out.
Does the Australian red meat industry need to improve its market diversification for when issues like this occur?
You know, Australia is fortunate that we have probably one of, if not the best, global market diversification in the world. And to be very fair, our red meat industry contemporaries such as the AMIC and our service company in MLA does a great job of marketing our beef to in excess of 80 countries around the world. The challenge is where you have a large buyer of our product, such as China, and last year they took over 300,000 tonnes, and they choose to do something that's highly inconsistent with their previous discussions and certainly our FTA, that does come to a shock to the industry. It's very hard to say that we need more because we've been doing a great job of getting that. It's just disappointing that the impact that's been caused from another part of the world is being applied to Australia, particularly when we have a very clear free trade agreement with China.
Cattle Australia Chair Gary Edwards speaking to Megan Hughes. Livestock SA Chair Gillian Fennell says the tariffs are news South Australian beef producers didn't need after another challenging season.
We send from South Australia, we send a lot of beef into China. In the 23-24 year, we sent 13% of our exports from South Australia over to China, so about $150 million worth. So it definitely has the capacity to impact on the conditions on the ground here in South Australia.
Well, this is like a perfect storm. I guess this is the news we didn't want to wake up to at the moment. You know, a lot of South Australia is still rainfall deficient. Some people are still waiting for rain. People are sitting down around the kitchen table, you know, around this week making big decisions about what they're going to buy, sell, keep or fatten or whatever. And it's going to have another straw on the camel's back when it comes to confidence within the sector. And, we just need... Well, we don't need, but if it doesn't rain in sufficient amounts, it's going to get really tight in South Australia. I think if we're having to compete, on the global scale for markets for what we do have, and trying to sort of take our small state into areas where we might not necessarily have been before to try and get the best value that we can. So it's not shaping up to be a great start to 2026.
Livestock SA Chair Gillian Fennell speaking with Emma Pedler. So what's behind China's decision? China said it wants to protect its domestic beef industry, which has been struggling to get established. But Professor of Agriculture at the Uni of Southern Queensland, Ben Loynes, told David Claughton they are also dealing with labour and feed shortages.
Well, it's very hard to understand a lot of the motivations because it's quite a convoluted system. But China tries to, overall at a very high level, China tries to manage its food trade or its agri-food trade. And this would be sort of, I don't know if it's specifically targeted to Australia because they've got a number of countries like Brazil, Argentina, New Zealand, Uruguay that export beef in a large scale or relatively large volume to China. So
they're all facing a big tariff, but they kick in at different levels. So ours
right.
is kicking in just a bit over 200,000 tonnes. I think the Brazilians, they've got 1.3 mil before they hit a tariff.
Yeah, and they exported to January, November. I think Brazil was about 1.1 million. So we were at looking at 295. So if we grandfathered and look back, we would have been paying 55% for about 90,000 tons. So yeah, so it's another chapter in the saga of Australian-China agricultural trade.
The intention behind, though, is to protect their own domestic industry. That's what the impression they gave.
They'd be worried about that. They've got this seesaw thing to do because their domestic industry is declining. The old sort of communist sort of data point of going up and to the right every year in the beef industry and in a number of agriculture industries is not the case with China's beef industry because of the opportunity costs in producing beef is too great. So people, a lot of Chinese peasantry have left the beef industry in China. We've seen a lot of aggregation or larger herd sizes to signify that. But also when you see their real census on cattle population, they have whilst it's sort of generally sort of rising, you see larger farms, so, you know, increasing number of herds of up to 100 head or over 10 head, whereas it used to be a lot of herds of 2 to 3 in size. So in actual fact, they're declining. And despite, you know, a lot of efforts to improve their genetics and look at feedlotting and intensive bovine agriculture in China's sort of had its ups and downs, David. So we might be, you know, they might be on another push to drive up their bovine production. I don't know. We haven't seen that as yet.
So you were suggesting that actually they're just not very good at producing beef. Is that what you're saying?
They're good at producing beef, but it's had a change. There's a lot of dynamics at play. And one of those key dynamics is the opportunity cost of farming in China is vis-a-vis other, you know, ways I could utilise my labour as a person out in the rural on a farm. I'd be better off going into town and work in construction. That's always been for the last 30 years, been a key tension in Chinese agriculture. They have a similar problem to Australia in many ways. It's a shortage of rural labour for agriculture.
That's Professor of Agriculture at the Uni of Southern Queensland, Ben Lyon, speaking there to David Claughton, ending that report by Elsie Adamo. It's just going on 17 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
With Selena Green on this Friday, well, for almost 8 long months, oyster growers at Stansbury in the York Peninsula have not been able to harvest or sell a single oyster. The region was one of the first parts of the state to close back in May when high levels of brevetoxins were detected linked to the harmful Karenia algae bloom. Late on New Year's Eve, though, Stansbury growers received the long-awaited and very much welcome news that they had been given the all-clear by authorities to reopen. On New Year's Day, I caught up with an exhausted and very happy grower, Paul D, who said it was the best news he could get coming into the new year.
Yeah, it really was. We were sort of expecting it, us oyster growers in Stansbury. We were waiting patiently. When the news came through from the manager of the Sasquatch program at Perza, I was just a bit exhausted and a little bit overwhelmed, I have to say. So I found out while I was driving along in our country towns, and I pulled over on the side of the road and had that meeting. We've had direct contact with Perza all the way, and they've been fantastic. It's very exhausting for all of us, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a long haul because you guys were the first to close. I mean, how many days all told between when you were told to close and you haven't been able to sell an oyster?
I'm not sure exactly. It's 240, 241, something like that. But I know it's 7 months and 3 weeks. So on Monday, it'll be 8 months. So, we're open as of New Year's Eve, 3 o'clock. In our town, we shut down our boat ramp at 7 p.m. for our fireworks. Our town was full of people. We had a fantastic night. And it was great. It was a really great night last night. We're all pretty happy. Bumped into a few growers down the street.
Yeah. Had it been a different day and the boat ramp would have been open, would you have been out there?
Yeah, maybe some of us. And one of the growers is going to start selling direct to the public on the 3rd of January from their shed. And then, I'll be getting out there and supplying the B&A fisheries in Stansbury. And, other growers, as they come back off of that holiday break, they'll be looking at selling oysters too.
So a sense of relief, do you think, is, as you say, exhaustion, because this has been such a long time, but some sense of relief amongst the growers there that, you know, you've finally got to this point of being reopened?
Yeah, it's definitely a sense of relief. It's also a reminder of why our South Australian Shellfish Quality Assurance Program is so important, because we're picking up on everything, that the oyster's picking up on everything that the ocean has, and our monitoring program picks up on all of that. So as we go through life, there's going to be other hurdles that we'll encounter. So for us oyster growers around South Australia, this isn't something that we're not new to. We sort of understand what's happening in the ocean, and we believe in the science, and we want to protect our water quality program at all costs, because we heavily rely on it to make sure our oysters are safe for human consumption.
The oysters that you've got out there, obviously you haven't been able to move them or do anything or touch them for some time now. So what kind of expectation of, I mean, how are they looking, and, you know, can you salvage anything out of those?
Yeah, we've got some of our growers have been very actively in just grading. So we can bring the oysters in and out of the, through 2025, we've been able to grade the oysters. Some growers, I've been one of them, we've just had to lay low because we've had almost zero cash flow, and we've just had to reduce our operating costs. So I sort of like run mine off a program called MyShell. So I do like desktop management of my farm. But I really need to get out there and move these oysters. I'm getting phone calls now. I'm getting a demand. Stansbury Oyster Growers also sell a lot of oysters to other farms around the state, and collectively we've got 3 million oysters ready to go, and there's growers that want them now. So I'm sort of keen to go after Monday, but yeah, today I'm going to have a day off and spend it with family, and then tomorrow I'll get out there and get into it.
If you're getting calls, I mean, obviously there's demand. So do you think, well, yeah, I mean, is that your expectation that there will be sort of a jump back into full production with that demand?
I do agree with that to a degree, but we've all lost customer base. We do have some ongoing commitments with people on other farms around the state. So that's all okay. And as for the consumer that comes to York Peninsula, I'm pretty sure that they might be a bit shy to start with, but the oysters do tell what the ocean's doing, and at the moment we have zero Karenia in all our bays along York Peninsula, which is fantastic news, and we're getting testing results on Mondays at this stage, so we really know what's going on, and as long as those levels are below the food safety standard, then everything's okay with PRRSA and for us to sell the oysters for human consumption. So, yeah, it's a long, Selena, it's just ongoing for us. There's always something going on. So, yeah, it's definitely a long road, and we're all tired, but our farms need us to get out there and get into it, and our region's supporting us 100%. As we all know, tourism's taken a bit of a kick in the guts through what's happening in the ocean, but we want tourism to continue to support the oyster industry, and we'll continue to support the tourism industry.
Yeah, because that's a really good point to make, is that, you know, we're obviously focused on what it means for individual growers, but it is, you know, it is a community. It is a community of growers, but it is a community as a whole that is impacted by this. It's been, by the sounds of it, an exhausting and very long road for everyone there.
Yeah, I was talking to the manager of our Stansbury markets last night in the street, and, yeah, it's just the support and, you know, just some of the kind words I was getting last night as I'm standing out there in the public. And, yeah, there's a lot of people supporting the oyster industry of Stansbury and the other bays as well on York Peninsula. Yeah, so we're ready to go, but I do know some of us growers are just having today off, and yeah, we'll be back out in the water tomorrow and going from there. Yeah, we've had through the year, I've been advocating a fair bit the industry over here and dealing with federal and state government and trying to get financial support for PRRSA to be able to afford to do all this monitoring, because we've sort of gone from 2-week monitoring and 4-week monitoring to weekly, and it's exhausted PRRSA's funds, and they need all the help they can get from the state government to continue to run the South Australian Shellfish Quality Assurance Program. So if anyone in the federal government and state government are listening to this, we really need your help to keep the SASQAP program alive and well, and then the oysters, shellfish industry can, can help tell in science what's in the water, because the shellfish accumulate the phytoplankton and anything that else is in the water. And through our really good quality assurance program, we can use science to educate the greater community.
As Stansbury oyster grower Paul D there speaking to me earlier, the next round of brevetoxin testing will be out on Monday. Here's some of what the Environment Minister Lucy Hood said on ABC Adelaide after the announcement.
Yes, we do have SASQAP, our monitoring system and testing regime. And so what we're able to do is when you see those levels kind of drop between 0.8 milligrams per kilogram for two consecutive weeks, and then you also see the Karenia species count decreasing, it means that we can open up those harvesting areas again. And so that has obviously happened in this case, and we're just absolutely thrilled for producers like Paul. It's wonderful.
Now, you can't guarantee it, of course, because we don't know what might happen, but do you feel optimistic, Minister, about Stansbury being able to continue to be open now that it has?
That's right. As we've seen over the last few weeks, those very zero to low levels of Karenia, in various areas across the state, in particular our metro areas, and obviously at Stansbury as well. And so it's cause for optimism. But it's important that we have these weekly testing with SASQAP. As Paul said, he wants to see those next rounds of tests as well, just to give him some assurance. But that's why we have this wonderful partnership, because it ensures that everyone has confidence in our oyster industry, and we very much want people to get out there and support those industries and eat a lot of oysters.
There are still oyster farms at Port Vincent, American River on KI and Kubawi who are not having such a happy start to the new year. What can you tell us about what may happen with them and when?
That's right. So it really is just a case of making sure that in two consecutive weeks you have continued to be under that 0.8 level, as well as the declining Karenia levels. So we are seeing those declining Karenia levels, which is fantastic. So once they have those two consecutive weeks, it means you can reopen those areas. So as you said, there's those closures in place at Kubawi, Port Vincent and American River. It's important to note, you can harvest pippies from the Coorong, but not for human consumption, just for bait. For fishing, and so we continue to monitor those. That's why we've invested heavily through our summer plan in testing and monitoring, and also, as Paul mentioned, in ongoing research and monitoring as well with our flow cytobot boys. So we're throwing everything at this, because we know just how important this sector is to South Australia.
As Environment Minister Lucy Hood there speaking to Lee Radford. 28 minutes past 12 here on the Country Hour with Selena Green. We better go to the Weather Bureau, and a very happy new year to our senior forecaster, Simon Timke. Hello.
Hello there, Selena. Thank you very much, and a happy new year to you and all your listeners as well.
And what is the weather doing on this, first cross to the Weather Bureau for the Country Hour in 2026?
Well, we're starting off with a mostly sunny day across the state. Looking at the satellite picture, we've got a little bit of low cloud about southern coasts, about the south coast of KI, the southeast coast of Eyre Peninsula there, and it's mostly cleared away from the southeast. So plenty of sunshine. We do have a little bit of higher cloud out near the western border there in the far west of the state. There is a chance there could be an isolated shower or thunderstorm in the far northwest. We've seen some thunderstorms in adjacent parts of the Northern Territory and Western Australia there. So a chance of a rumble of thunder and flash of lightning in the far northwest. But elsewhere, I think staying dry and mostly sunny. Maximum temperatures today, generally sort of about average for this time of year, maybe a little bit above average in the south. And we're seeing those temperatures sort of scooting up now around the place. We're up to around, I think, the warmest places, probably Udnadatta, sitting on around 37 degrees at the moment, but some of those places in the north not too far behind. Over the next couple of days, we won't see a lot of change in the weather. We are under the influence of a high-pressure ridge over waters to the south that's giving us fairly stable conditions. There is a sort of a weak little trough that's lingering up in the far northeast over the weekend, which might produce an isolated shower or possibly even a thunderstorm in the northeast on Saturday and Sunday. And there is also a trough over western Victoria and sort of southwestern New South Wales that's likely to produce a little bit of weather over those states. We might even see a thunderstorm associated with that sort of extend back along parts of SA, sort of adjacent parts there, possibly into the Riverland, the Murraylands, maybe even up into the mid-north and the northeastern part of the Flinders Ranges. But if we do see a storm over those areas, unlikely to have much in the way of rainfall associated with it. So a flash of lightning and a rumble of thunder, but not much in the way of rainfall, I don't think. Winds on Saturday likely to be southwest to southeasterly, so not getting too hot, and they will sort of, those winds will freshen near the coast with afternoon sea breezes. For Sunday, dry pretty much right across the state, just that chance of a shower, a thunderstorm in the far northeast. And then on Monday, dry and sunny right across the state, I think, and we'll start to see temperatures rising sort of early to mid next week as well. The high pressure system that's got that ridge across the south will actually move east early to mid next week, turning our winds around a little bit more northerly, and that'll start to see those temperatures rise too. So sort of through the middle part of next week, expecting some very hot conditions right across the state. I think extending across sort of western and northern parts during Tuesday, we'll see sort of fairly widespread maximum temperatures into the low 40s on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday that heat extending right across the state. I think most places will see maximum temperatures into the 40s on Wednesday next week, and persisting over large areas of the state on Thursday. So some very hot conditions on the way for the middle part of next week, Selena.
All right. Well, if people are planning ahead, that's good to know that's on its way. Thanks, Simon. And I guess really, yeah, as we said, cumulative rainfall figures, there's really nothing to report
pretty much
there.
Nothing, pretty much nothing to speak of for the week ahead. So dry conditions and getting very hot.
All right. Thanks, Simon. Stay cool.
Thanks, Selena.
Simon Timke there, our senior forecaster today at the Weather Bureau. For the western inland parts of New South Wales for Saturday, the upper western district mostly sunny with a slight chance of a shower in the northeast and near zero chance elsewhere. There's a chance of a thunderstorm in the east in the afternoon and early evening. The lower western district a mostly sunny morning, then with a chance of a thunderstorm arriving in the far east in the afternoon. And both districts are facing overnight temperatures around 20 degrees. During the day, they should climb up to around 40. It's 27 minutes to one.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Have you been out cherry picking yet? If you're putting it off, you might want to get a wriggle on, because some South Australian cherry growers are reporting not just a later season this year, but also a shorter one, and some are starting to sell out altogether. Is it looking the same for apples? Might they be early and short this year as well? Also coming up, a chance to delve into the history of a fascinating South Australian woman whose wine label is incredibly well known the world over, but her contribution to the wine industry, not so much. You'll learn her story after we get news headlines from Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, a vigil has been held at a Swiss ski resort for the victims of a deadly fire at a New Year's Eve party. About 40 people were killed and another 115 were injured when the fire ripped through the bar in Kran, Montanar. Early morning Thursday local time, one Australian was injured and the cause of the blaze is not yet known. CFS volunteers are on the ground in Western Australia assisting local crews who've been battling multiple blazes in recent weeks. A combination of firefighters and specialist incident management personnel from across SA are aiding in firefighting efforts in Boddington in WA South. And Brisbane Lions AFL star Lachie Neal has stepped down as co-captain of the reigning premiers over issues involving his private life. The 32-year-old has fronted the press confirming reports of a relationship breakdown with his wife Jules. He declined to elaborate but says he's deeply sorry for what's occurred. His teammates were informed of his decision this morning as they prepare for a tilt at a third straight premiership in 2026. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, yes, it is peak time for cherries in and around the Adelaide Hills. The pre-Christmas rush is over and some growers are already starting to look at winding up their sales amid a later and shorter cherry season. And despite the late start and a big Christmas buy-up, cherries are still very much in hot demand. Gavin Plummer runs Plummer's Pick Your Own in the Adelaide Hills.
Yeah, so cherries have been a late start this year, obviously, with the cold and sort of wet spring, you know, right up to November, it's sort of really put the cherry crop behind probably a couple of weeks. We sort of start usually, you know, late November, early December, so it sort of pushed it through till sort of mid-December we sort of opened. And, yeah, it's sort of well on a track now and sort of even sort of heading towards the end of it for us. So.
Important that you were sort of up able to get going before Christmas. That's usually what that week or so before Christmas would be, no doubt, the busiest time.
Yeah, generally, you know, it's always always good. Like everyone wants cherries for Christmas, and leading up to Christmas is, you know, it's a very busy time, and that's when people want them. Obviously, a lot of people buying them and from themselves and their families, and like to take them to Christmas and that. So it was nice to get a couple of weeks still in before Christmas, and even now, like there's still people around at the moment looking to pick your own at the moment, and a lot of people are selling out. Sort of fast. So this year has sort of South Australia wide, it's sort of only been a sort of a light to medium crop. It hasn't been a heavy crop of cherry. So a lot of people are sort of selling out like now. So for that reason. So yeah.
Yeah. So what were, I guess, the conditions that caused things to be a slightly smaller crop and be a bit of a later crop? What was that sort of crucial period that sort of pushed it back?
Yeah, I guess it's just that the cool spring, you know, you could chill hours and that in winter and stuff would help, but being so cold in spring and not having the warm days sort of pushed it behind, and even sort of now I'd say like the cherries are probably not as sweet as what they are in other years just because there just hasn't been a lot of sun, like obviously the last couple of weeks, but before that there, you know, there wasn't a lot of sun around and heat that sort of helps with the sugars. So
it looks like your selling season will wrap up a little bit quicker as well than normal.
Yeah, so we're sort of open the other day, and we're probably going to open for Saturday one more day, I reckon, and that'll probably be pretty much us out, I think. Yeah, unfortunately, it'd be nice to have more, but that's just the way it is, unfortunately. But yeah, we've had lots of people come through, so it's been really great to see so many people come through, and you know, it's getting bigger and bigger, the pick your own sort of cherries and even apples. You know, we do apples some sort of late February to May. And you know, having an apple straight off the tree is certainly worth something, like to experience. It's, you know, nice and fresh and crispy and juicy. It's sort of, you have one off the tree and you'll sort of never go back. So it is getting bigger to pick your own in any sort of fruit. So it's really good that people and families are trying to get out there and get a bit of fresh air in the hills and you know, and learn what it's all about. So it's really good to see.
So once you've wrapped up your cherries, obviously the attention will focus on apples next. So are they looking to start around about normal?
I'd say they're probably going to be a week or two later as well, the apples. So, you know, it's sort of that sort of late February. So it could even be that like early March sort of thing. Yeah, it's a bit early to know just yet, but I would say it probably will be a bit late, yeah.
Mm. So how's it looking out in the orchard at the moment?
Yeah, no, pretty good, actually. It's a reasonable crop of apples sort of in all varieties. So just sort of doing some thinning at the moment where, you know, some contractors go through and pull a few apples off the tree. You know, you might only want 150 apples on the tree and there could be, you know, 300 or 400 or more. So they just sort of go through and thin a couple and put them on the ground so the other ones can, you know, get the size that they need to, that they've got room to grow. So, no, they're looking really good at the moment, and obviously it hasn't been too hot yet. If you get a few warmer days, you might sort of get a bit of suntan and sunburn, but Yeah, no, it's looking good at the moment. And, you know, we've had plenty of water sort of up through to, you know, December. So we've sort of had to keep the pumps off until early December. So, you know, it's been good that way too.
I think we spoke around this time last year. It had been pretty significantly dry. Has this year been a little bit more forgiving weather-wise for you?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Like I said, we've only sort of just started irrigating the last couple of weeks. So, you know, when you're not irrigating real early, you obviously save a lot of pumping costs with electricity and whatnot, and save your bores and your dams a lot more. So it's certainly been a lot better that way. Going forward, they're talking a dry, hot summer. So we'll see, I guess. Yeah.
Gavin Plummer there from Plummer's Pick Your Own in the Adelaide Hills. Now, since we're speaking of cherries, each year supermarket retailers actually reject hundreds of thousands of kilos of imperfect cherries for their slightly odd shapes and sizes. Produce Box subscription service Farmers Pick has this season diverted 140,000 kilograms of these cherries from going to waste. Its director and co-founder Josh Ball says he was shocked to learn of the volume of cherries that are rejected by the supermarkets considering their extremely short season.
With cherries, we see thousands, if not millions, of kilos wasted every year because of the way they look. And we thought this year, let's go on a mission to save 140,000 kilos of them before they're left out in the field.
And that's just due to minor imperfections?
Yeah, minor imperfections drive cherries being rejected. So sometimes they're too small, they're not red enough, or they're just missing the stem. And that's enough for them to get knocked back from being perfect.
We've been hearing a lot from producers that the weather has been stalling the season as well. So is this 140,000 just what's currently in the supply chain or what's coming up into Christmas?
For us, this is 140,000 kilos over the whole season coming into Christmas. We have seen a delayed season due to weather. It's been a little bit chilly for the cherries to grow, but they're definitely starting to come on strong over this week, and the next week we'll start to see a big flush probably of supply.
What are some of the most common imperfections you'll see on a cherry? You mentioned that it could just be a stem that's missing.
The size and the shape is usually the biggest problem. One of my favourite ones is when we get double cherries, so you'll get two of them attached to each other, and the taste is very, very rarely impacted. And usually they're just, you know, they're juicy and delicious, just like any other cherry would be. Imperfections are also a big one, but they really have no impact on the flavour.
Were you shocked about how much potential waste there could be in this supply chain, considering we're coming up to the period of the year where cherries are most popular?
Cherries have such a short season. There's only, you know, 6, 8, maybe 10 weeks of the year where cherries are growing, and, you know, Aussies absolutely love them coming into Christmas. So to see any of them go to waste is a bit of a shock horror to us.
When you're speaking with farmers, do the supermarkets have any kind of plans to change this and maybe have like imperfect cherries that you could buy at a cheaper price or that you could use in things like stuffing for a turkey for Christmas?
When we talk to cherry farmers, we find that there's very rarely different outlets for them to sell their cherries, which is why we try and position ourselves as, you know, an alternative that can help them move the unwanted stock, even though they taste absolutely delicious.
Farmers Pick's been going for a number of years now. So what kind of overall impact has your organisation had on the food supply chain and waste?
Yeah, Farmers Pick started over 5 years ago when me and a mate saw a bendy carrot at a market and thought, what's going on here? When we discovered that so much food and produce is left out on the farm and goes to waste because of how it looks, not how it tastes, we thought we had to do something. So since we started about 5 years ago, we've saved over 10 million kilos direct from the farm and, yeah, delivered direct to households across Australia.
And if someone is listening that is interested in joining Farmers Pick, what kind of areas of Australia do you service?
Currently, we primarily service the east coast of Australia, including a big showing in regional Australian areas, as well as obviously city and metro regions. We're always looking for new farmers to supply from and try and work in and understand their waste and growing patterns. They can reach out via our website at farmerspick.com.au. Love to hear from you.
That's the director and co-founder of Farmers Pick, Josh Ball, there speaking to Jane McNaughton. So that was pre-Christmas. They'd already diverted 140,000 kilograms of odd cherries from going to waste. So you can only imagine that now post-Christmas, that number would have climbed significantly. It is 16 minutes away from the 1 o'clock news.
And this could get on
Sunday. Join ABC Sport for the fifth Ashes Test between Australia and England.
Hear every ball of the cricket all summer long.
The Ashes.
On your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're with Selena Green on this Friday. Great to have your company. Let's take a bit of a trip into history now. And if you think of Penfolds and Grange, now these are names synonymous with quality Australian wine and very known here in South Australia, Australia-wide and internationally. But how much do you know about the woman behind these names? Mary Penfold was a pioneer and leader in the Australian wine and business world, developing her garden vineyard in the Adelaide Hills into a wine empire that still exists today. 130 years after her death, an Australian author says he's proud to have finally shed more light on her story with his new book, Mary Penfold. That author is Grant Lee Keyser, and I asked him why he wanted to tell Mary Penfold's story.
Well, I was always interested in the history of Australian wine. I mean, wine is such a big industry for Australia, and it's right from the very first days of European settlement in Australia, it's been part of Australian life. You look at the early paintings of the Europeans arriving at Sydney Cove, they stood around the flagpole and raised tankards of wine to salute the future of the new colony. So wine has been an integral part of Australian life right since the very first European settlement. So I wanted to explore the history of Australian wine, and as I did so, the name of Mary Penfold kept sticking out as somebody whose story hadn't really been told, because she operated and built the foundations of her huge business at a time when women were pretty much ignored in the corporate world in the 1870s.
So that said, when you went back to investigate and research her involvement in, you know, this incredible wine brand and her establishment of that here in Australia, was there a lot of recorded material? Were you able to find a lot of information and detail about her role?
Well, there was some very interesting correspondence, some fascinating correspondence with her parents when she first came to Australia, how brokenhearted they were at her leaving and the dire financial predicament her husband, Christopher Rawson Penfold, had landed her in and her young family. So there was those sorts of family elements. But I was able to check British newspapers from 200 years ago about their lives in Brighton and in London before that. And I was able to find a lot of information in the State Library of South Australia about her business, M. Penfold and Company, which I'd never seen before. I mean, that was the first name of Penfold's, M. Penfold and Company, Mary Penfold. And there were actually newspaper reports in the early 1870s, not long after her husband passed away, when her business was still very much a cottage industry operating from her cottage called The Grange. And the way within a few short years she transformed it. So the Adelaide newspapers documented the rise of her business empire in the 1870s, and I thought that was absolutely fascinating. I mean, Christopher Penfold has always been sort of portrayed as the man who kicked off the business, but when you look at the newspaper accounts and correspondence and business records, Penfold's was just a very small kitchen operation making medicinal wines until Christopher Penfold passed away in 1870, and then Mary took it from just a backyard operation with the vines out the back and turned it into a huge business within a few years. Quite extraordinary.
Yeah, so give us a bit of an idea of that very early beginnings. What brought the family here to South Australia at the time? Because, as you said, they weren't coming from a wine family. The intention wasn't to come to South Australia and set up a wine business.
No, in the 1840s, Christopher Penfold was working as a doctor. He was a young doctor. He had a medical practice in Brighton, not far from where he'd grown up as a vicar's son in Sussex. The Penfolds had a reputation for getting into a lot of financial trouble, and so it was with Christopher Penfold. He married young Mary Penfold, who was the daughter of quite a successful doctor in London and from a fairly well-to-do family, but he got them into financial trouble in Brighton where they couldn't pay their debts, and so Christopher Penfold saw the opportunity just at that time. There were many, many advertisements in London, a great buzz throughout England about the new colony of South Australia and the opportunities for British people to gain large sections of farmland at fairly reasonable prices. And so with whatever money he could round up, he bought about 200 hectares just on the outskirts of the Adelaide city at a place called McGill. And they set up as wheat farmers. He was going to make his fortune as a wheat farmer and also operating as a country doctor in that area. But over time, and that was their life for about 20 years, they were wheat farmers. Christopher Penfold got a job in Victoria during a smallpox crisis as a vaccinator. His occupation was a vaccinator in St Kilda, doing inoculations. But then they returned to South Australia in the 1860s, still had their wheat farm. But by that stage, South Australian table wines were growing in popularity, and Mary saw the opportunity to expand their farming interests by planting more grapes. And so that's what they did. And when Christopher Penfold died in 1870, she took what was still a very small vineyard. Within a few years, it's said that she had 400,000 litres of wine in storage because she was buying up all the grapes of the vineyards around her and farms around her and making wine in these vast buildings that are still there, what they called her wine manufactory at McGill. And from there, she was turning her little operation into a major, major winemaker in Australia with markets in all the Australian colonies and before long, markets overseas as well.
So she actually brought, or they did bring some vines with them when they immigrated to Australia to plant, and that was sort of the very beginnings of then what became this sort of empire.
They brought some Grenache vines with them from which had been sourced in the south of France and in Portugal. But in the early 1840s, when the Penfolds arrived in Adelaide, Adelaide was still very much a frontier town at the time, and the port was known as Port Misery, Port Adelaide, because it was so antiquated and such in such a diabolical state. But they did bring some vine cuttings with them, but they were also able to buy lots of vines from the farmers around them. In the early 1840s, vineyards were already being established at a number of farms around Adelaide and later on in the Barossa Valley and the Clare Valley. So they were able to source more vines for their vineyard, and it just grew and grew over time. But it didn't really take off until Mary Penfold took over the company in its entirety.
My guest today is Grant Lee Keyser. He is the author of a new book on Mary Penfold. It tells the story of the life of a really pioneering South Australian woman who was behind what is today and continues to be a very world famous wine label. Now, the name The Grange, the origin of that, it was a name given to what, a part of the property. It wasn't sort of an intention of that to become a label or a brand for the wine initially.
No, the property became known as The Grange in the 1840s. Mary named her little cottage. It's still there at McGill, a five-room cottage, and still very much in its original state. But she named it The Grange, which was just a common name at the time for a farmhouse. And she began making her first batch of wine was made in the late 1840s, and she wrote about that. She made what she called 10 gallons of wine, or about 45 litres, on the kitchen table in the cottage. And in time, in the 1950s, when Max Schubert, who was then Penfold's chief winemaker, was experimenting with wines and wanted to make a great wine, he named it Grange Hermitage after Mary's cottage, The Grange.
So how pioneering was this at the time, Grantley? I mean, obviously there was a wine industry, although perhaps, yeah, you know, in a fledgling way, but there were people planting vines and making wines in Australia definitely by that point. But for a woman to be doing it, especially in this manner, how pioneering was that?
That's right. It was extraordinary for a woman. Women, the wives of a lot of the winemakers and farmers, were obviously involved in growing grapes and making wine. But for the amazing thing about Mary Penfold is she took literally an industry that started on her kitchen table, and within a few years had laid the foundation for a huge business. And that was an extraordinary thing in the 1870s, at a time when women just didn't run major businesses in Australia. But she not only ran the business and oversaw the blending of the wine to her specifications, exactly to her specifications, and she employed people who really knew the wine industry to look after her vineyards. A man named Joseph Gillard, who was a very well-known winemaker in South Australia, was instrumental to her success. But the newspaper reports of the time stressed that she was the director of the whole operation. She was the commander-in-chief. So everything was happening to her specifications. And that was an amazing thing for the 1870s. So amazing that it generated quite a lot of media interest at the time. And even more remarkably than that, before long, Mary was sending her wines to major wine exhibitions around the world, and her port and other wines that she was making were winning prestigious medals at huge international wine shows, which not only enhanced the name of the Penfolds brand, the reputation of the Penfolds brand, but also all the wines coming out of Australia at the time.
So clearly someone with a very sharp business mind, but also a good mind and a palate for wine as well. What a combination. No wonder it was a success.
Very much. And she was obviously an extremely determined person as well, because when her husband, Christopher Penfold, died, she was encouraged by members of her family to sell the property and just live off the proceeds from the sale of the land. But she was determined. She now had a taste for business, and she had a confidence in making world-class wines, and she decided to run with it and build the business as well as she could, so that by the 1880s she was like a major international name in wine, and she laid the foundations for the generations of Penfolds who took over the business in the future.
Grantley Keyser is my guest. He is the author of a new book on Mary Penfold. The book details her pioneering role in establishing this world-renowned wine label and a pioneering role in the Australian wine industry. Grantley, obviously it's a lot easier to sort of find a roadmap of someone's life from historical documents. Were you able to put together a bit of an idea of or learn anything of her character and her personality, of what she was like as a person?
Well, very much. She was. Her nickname was the Commander in Chief. So she obviously had a very powerful personality, and you just know by the way that she was building the business and the way that she stood up to family members who wanted her to retire, that she was a very, very single-minded person. But she was also a person who really cared about her family, and that comes through in the letters that she wrote to her grandchildren, and the fact that one of her grandchildren, a young lady named Inez, lived with her for the most of her life. When Mary had become widowed, Inez moved from Melbourne to South Australia to live with Mary, and Mary treated her with great, great fondness. And when Inez died very, very young, she was in her 20s, Mary, from her own pocket, paid to have a book of her poetry published. And she really paid enormous tribute to the granddaughter. And she funded a large memorial in the McGill Cemetery to her granddaughter. And I think it's significant that Mary never really was given the credit for her business success in her life. When she died, there was virtually no real tributes or obituaries to her, except that she was the wife of the well-known Adelaide doctor, Christopher Penfold. That's about all that Mary got. And even the cemetery, She was buried with her granddaughter Inez, and while Inez has the large monument, Mary Penfold just has a little plaque at the bottom of the granddaughter's monument, which I thought was quite amazing that this great wine pioneer and pioneer of South Australian business had met such an anonymous end, as it were.
So do you feel now that this book has been published, it's given Mary a bit more of the due role of what she achieved and what she began?
Oh, very much. And as I say, I was really proud to write the story, because it's an aspect of Australian life and Australian history that I think deserves to be told. And I think Mary Penfold is a name that really deserves to be celebrated as a woman who in times which were very chauvinistic and where women weren't given a great deal of credit for their success, really laid the foundations for a great business, but also helped the Australian wine industry really prosper at a time when it was starting to take off.
And the wine industry loves a great story, unique origin story. I mean, great wine is all about the story behind it as well. I don't imagine, I mean, this is a prestigious label, prestigious, much sought after name in wine, a pretty special origin story to go with it.
Yeah, and, you know, my book is not just the story of Mary Penfold, but it's also the story of the early days of Australian wine. And I pay tribute and tell the stories of all the great Australian winemakers who even came before Mary Penfold, you know, right from the very first days, people such as the great sheep baron, John MacArthur, who's known for, you know, the pioneer of the Merino wool industry. He was also a very prominent wine grower at the time, and his sons really did a lot in the 1850s to help pioneer Australian wine to overseas markets in Europe. So I was very happy to tell Mary's story, but also to tell the story of Australian wine, which is such an important industry.
That was Grantley Keyser there speaking to me. He's the author of Mary Penfold, that is a new book. It's out now and it's been published by HarperCollins. Maybe some good summertime reading for you. That's it for me for today. Selena Green bringing you the Country Hour. I'll be back on Monday to bring you the Country Hour again. We will be here, even though it is will be cricket day. Surely it'll still be going on Monday. Yeah, so the last test coming out of Sydney. So make sure you tune in at noon for the Country Hour and have your digital streams ready if you'd like to catch us for the whole full hour. I'll have a full hour program for you, but you'll just get the 30 minutes if you're listening on your radio, on our digital streams, ABC Listen, and on our website if you'd like to catch the full hour. Have a great rest of your Friday afternoon. Have a safe and happy weekend. I'll catch you next week. It's time now for the 1 o'clock news.
Are you a long-time listener? Or maybe a first-time caller? The ABC Listen app makes it easy to join the conversation. Download the app for free and use the call text buttons to get in touch with your favourite radio programs live. Download the ABC Listen app today.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.